Hey guys, this is Jake from Dialed In with Jake and Zach. And before we get into the show, a quick word from Dylan at Law Chevrolet.
Hey guys, it's Dylan out here at Law Chevrolet Buick in Boonville, Indiana. For the month of December, we're running employee pricing on our 2018 Chevrolet models, all of them. We're talking Cruises, Malibus, Equinoxes, your Traverses, your Silverados, and that's even on your Tahoes and Suburbans. Huge rebates. Big discounts, especially around the holidays. Everybody wants to save as much money as possible for our drag racing family. Guys, we understand how important it is to get to the racetrack each weekend. I know how important it is for me as well as Steve and Chad and Josh here. We want to try and help you guys out as much as possible. If you guys come and purchase a vehicle from us, we're going to give you $600 on a Visa card. Hopefully that helps you guys get to the racetrack maybe twice, maybe get some gas money, maybe need your fees. For some of us, that's definitely going to be buyback money. I may see you guys in the buyback line myself. But like I said, huge discounts for the month of December. So come down here and see us. We're located in Boonville, Indiana. Our phone number is 812-897-2220. So give us a call and we'd be glad to help you guys out. Thank you.
Here we go, staging them up on the left-hand lane. The Throwdown Motorsports 65 Chevy 2, 626 on the dial, it's Zach Slump. On the right-hand side, the Icon Pistons Diamond Engine and Machine 74 Vega Wagon, 592 on the dial, it's Jake Hodge.
Episode 14, in a Japanese term, it would be Zhu Yan, in honor of who, Zach?
Kenji Okazaki.
Yeah, if you want to take a minute to tell people who that is, and me included, that'd be great.
Okay. Merle, I don't know exactly when his career started, but he was a funny car driver that drove for Big Jim Dunn, a Moon Eyes car. I can't remember. I had a video, I think it was Drag Racing 1990 on VHS that I wore out when I was a kid, where like you had to do the tracking on the VHS because it had been watched so many times. And he had won a race, I believe it was that year. I'm probably, you know, drag racing historians might be, I might be wrong on this, but I believe he won. I know he won one national event. I believe it was during that year. He was a tiny little guy from Japan, and man, he was a great driver. He was known for his reaction times. Were really good. I know there's some fire videos, you know, the old funny cars and all the fire underneath the body. So yeah, I had thought about what language to use, and then I found the 14 in Japanese, and then it made me think of Kenji Okazaki. So then I looked him up on Facebook, and he's got a Facebook page. So everybody go out and like Kenji Okazaki's Facebook page, because he was a cool driver.
Yeah, it's probably a question that we should have asked our guest today, but it's all right. We got to leave something to long for.
Right.
Yeah, it's been a pretty quiet weekend around my house this weekend. I got back from Canada Friday and had a birthday party for old Easton Saturday, because we were obviously in Huntsville for his birthday. And of course, he thought he needed a trampoline park birthday party to go along with drag racing. So.
Well, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And there was somebody else had a birthday too, right? I think the co-host that dialed in here turned 25. So happy birthday, Jake.
Yeah, thanks. Quarter of a way to 100, and still not as old as Jenna.
She's going to kill you, buddy. But
yeah, it's all right. I've got it coming. For you. is it bad that I said that and looked over my shoulder?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm currently in at this address.
Right. Yeah, you might want to tell everybody. This isn't live, but maybe she'll edit that out. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. Probably not. She's a good sport about it.
Yeah.
We did some slot car racing.
Slot car racing Santa Showdown. Tell us about that.
Oh, I did not go to the Santa Showdown because I
you
do
did
not belong.
Oh, okay.
I should probably send my kid though. We went to slot car racing Sunday, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with much slot car racing, which the first round, everybody puts $2 into a pot, and the best light in first round is called light money. Of course, towards the end of the round, I'm randomly paired up with 1 7-year-old with the same last name, and he's 001 dead three, and I am not. I ended up being about 70 behind that, hitting the bottom, of course, because that's my normal bottom spot. And 7-year-old took some light money from all the adults. So that was pretty cool. It's not the first time he's done that either. Just wish it wasn't with me in the other lane, because he's 7 years old and he'll let you know that he just did that and won't let you forget about it. So yeah, my 7-year-old won the light money pot on a lap against me. So that kind of rounded out my weekend of slot car racing and what it was my birthday weekend.
Nice. Nice. Well, that's good. He's beating up on the old man starting out early. I'm sure there's more of that to come. Yeah. The slot car racing, man, I don't know. I need another hobby to pour money into, but it does look like a lot of fun. My dad and I race slot cars and actually drag race slot cars as well in New Jersey when I was like, I think we started when I was about 6. So, but we still got some old ones, very old ones somewhere at my dad's house in the basement, I'm sure. So it was a lot of fun back then. So yeah, I can definitely see it being fun now.
Yep, it's a good time, and it's very addictive, and there's a lot of guys that we race with on a weekly basis that are into it that you don't realize. And guys, you know, even guys like Champ that show up every weekend and even promote their own races.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, Santa Showdown was last weekend, and I don't have all the results, but Steve Collier won the high roller race, and Steve's a well-renowned bottom bulber in our part of the world, I would say. And Cupcake Michael Jones won the main event at Santa Showdown over my cousin Brandon Hodge, who was 000-something red in the final, and Cupcake was 30-something.
But, and what did that pay to win?
I don't know. I think Brandon runnered up and semi'd and got like $2,300.
Wow.
The slot car million was also last weekend, and it was out in like Oklahoma, I think, Tulsa. Mm-hmm. And Preston Ridge, or Lil Rat as they call him, won $7,500 at the slot car million. So
oh, that's awesome.
Paying as much as a big car. And yeah, if you guys are interested, get in touch with Zach or myself and we'll send you to the right way to create this really, really bad habit that ruins all the racing plans for the next year, usually because you spend too much money on them.
Right, right. Yeah. Speaking of that, saving my money and fixing stuff, I got out in the garage this weekend, got to diagnose the car a little bit. You know, I was really trying to, also wanted to get the transmission out so I can get it over to Firecracker Performance, you know, and didn't look like there's anything wrong on that end, that's for sure. You know, found a little metal in the oil and that kind of stuff. And I want to preface this because I wanted to say, you know, my dad, Billy Schlump, you know, he takes the engine stuff very seriously. And he doesn't like necessarily when I tell people that I've had engine problems, but, you know, it wasn't anything that happened because there was any detail missed. I mean, and if anybody would be to blame, it would be me. I put it together myself. From what I remember, I tightened everything up on it. I double, triple checked everything. It's just one of the things that happened. It wouldn't have ran from the middle of September into November if, you know, it was put together wrong. It's just, you know, it's just one of them unfortunate things. And we will get it fixed and, you know, just... Yeah, I'll be more experienced for me to put it back together again, and it'll be better for next year. So, you know, it's just one of them things. The way I'm trying to look at it, I'm going to try to stay positive and just take it as another learning experience. And then at least it happened when I have plenty of time to fix it. That's the other thing. I'm not missing races this time, you know, that I wouldn't have to travel a super long way to go do. So we'll get it back up and running before too long. And how about the Vega wagon, Jake? Are we going to see that anytime in 2019?
Ooh, yeah, actually, it's coming along quite nicely. I did the cheap route on the engine the last couple of years and had buddies here and buddies there that helped out and helped with assembly and stuff. But and I appreciate that immensely. But it's going to be all new.
Mm-hmm.
It's up at Diamond Engine and Machine right now. Aaron Dysinger's got it. The guy that's famous for being 60 and going dead on. He needs money to fix the front end of his Malibu where it got backed into at the No Box Nationals. So we're going to go ahead and bought an aftermarket block and new rotating assembly and still got the profiler heads and intake, but going to be a nice piece. And I think that, you know, I can beat on it like I used to when I was had time to meticulously maintain things before they started all going to heck in a handbasket.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. It'll be good to see the old car roll back out and turn on some wind lights, I'm sure. And, I mean, already looking at this schedule for next year, my goodness, it's just this momentum of big money purses is just continuing. And I think 2019 is going to be definitely going to be one for the record books for everybody.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm going to call Capital One and see what kind of break they'll cut me on some interest deals because I'm sure the fuel card is going to be rolling.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. Yep, traveling is definitely in our future for next year, and gonna go after it hard, and can't wait for it to get here. Of course, I'll say that more when I have a race car that'll start and move on its own. That'll be nice. So yeah, what else is going on? Practice tree races. I know we got some of those coming up.
Ooh, breaking news!
Breaking news!
The Law Chevrolet Buick practice tree race tentatively scheduled for December 21st, and they're moving it to the FOP in Boonville, the Fraternal Order of Police there. Steve doesn't want anybody getting hurt in the shop at the dealership. We all get pretty rowdy and have a good time, and it keeps growing. So as a liability standpoint, we're going to move it to the FOP in Boonville. And what a safer place do you have in the Fraternal Order of Police?
Nice. Yeah, keep everybody in line a little bit. Yeah, looking forward to that for sure. I plan on making an appearance, and we will work that out. And yeah, it's going to be a great time. Go see, and everybody that hasn't been to that before, make the trip. It'll be a good time. Sure, it'll be a great atmosphere with a lot of good bench racing going on, and probably a little bit of smack talking on the practice tree.
No, we would never have that. No.
No. No, not at all.
Last year I did bet Don O'Neill $20 a hit, and I ended up $40 down on the money. But that's neither here nor there anymore. Yeah, this weekend is PRI, and I know you said you couldn't attend, but the Kris Kringle Crackdown at Innovative Slots, a big slot car race. Actually having a 3-day race, and it's $2,000 to win Saturday. So they always have cars there that you could purchase and race, and it's a pretty good time. And if you guys are at PRI and you are interested in slot cars, just look up Innovative Slots on Facebook or InnovativeSlots.com. So I'll be live on Motor Mania. I'll be announcing that Saturday. Motor Mania on a slot car race is a pretty unique deal every time it happens. But Zach, I think that's about all we've got. Our interviews, I think throughout the winter, will probably be carrying most of the episode. And this one was one for the record books, a guy that is incredible. Not only in his knowledge of the sport, but his gumption for wanting the sport to succeed. It's quite incredible.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a good listen to all of our listeners. This guy is a drag racing encyclopedia. His enthusiasm for the sport is infectious. This guy has got one heck of a TV radio announcer's voice, that's for sure. So I think everybody's going to enjoy our interview with Brian Loans.
Yeah, I think you would agree with me that I think we've hit a home run the last 2 weeks with our interviews, and everybody that is listening to this, all seven of you, next week is going to be no different. We discussed that, and it's going to be a good time, I think, with a guy that speaks up about the sport quite a bit, and it's pretty risky when he does it. So that's about all we're going to tell you.
Yeah, it's a good teaser. That's right. Yeah. That's what they call in the industry a teaser, right? So
Yeah.
Tune in next week. And thank you all for listening to it. And I think everybody's going to enjoy it. Like Jake was saying, we don't have a ton of racing to talk about. We're going to talk racing with people. And I think that you all will enjoy what's to come here on Dialed In.
Yep. And with that being said, here's our interview with Mr. Brian Loans. So today we have a guest with us that publicly admits that Tony Pedregon is good for the Fox Sports 1 broadcast, the only guy that can rock a comb over in aviators better than Tom Cruise, a guy that can tolerate Lee Sebring for 5 days straight. You can see him Monday, December 3rd for the 3K Hoopty Challenge, the host of Put Up or Shut Up, and the newest edition of the NHRA Fox Sports 1 broadcast. Mr. Brian Loans, how's it going, man?
I'm doing good, man. You said that opener was going to be epic, and it was. That was really well done. I like it.
Yep, only fitting.
Totally good. No, thanks for having me on the show, guys.
Yeah, yep. We are extremely excited to have you here, Brian, and thank you so much for joining us on Dialed In. And if you would kind of give us an overview, if you will, your history in racing, how you got involved, background, history of yourself. Sure.
Yeah, so, I mean, for me, growing up, my dad was a drag racer in the 70s, and I was born in the early 80s, so when I came around, he kind of stopped racing, but he didn't get away from cars. He restored Pontiacs and stuff like that when I was a kid, so I've always been around cars through my dad, and that's really how I started watching drag racing when I was a kid. And, I guess it was just one of those things, something about drag racing clicked with me, and loved the sport since I was old enough to watch it on television and read National Dragster and all that stuff, and started working at racetracks in college. I was a, you know, I was a bracket racer. I always tell people I was the, you know, worst bracket racer that ever lived, but I bracket raced with my dad at New England Dragway for 4 or 5 years before I kind of started, before I realized that I was a way better announcer than I'd ever be a racer. Then I kind of, my dad still races there to this day, races the same car I was driving at that point back when I was a kid. You know, when I was in through college, I started working at Lebanon Valley Dragway in New York. I worked at New England Dragway back and forth. I do like Friday nights at Lebanon. Then I drive over to Epping and do Saturday and Sunday, and I kind of work a schedule there. And I did some SCCA road racing stuff in college. And for me, New England Dragway really was kind of like the place where it all came together for me. So in terms of, you know, making the move to do this on a professional level, it was the IHRA that I started announcing national events for. And it was me and Brian Olson and Bob Unkerfer that were the three guys that did most of the IHRA events from, say, 2002, 2003, all the way up through, you know, maybe 2010 or 11. And then that's when I kind of stepped back from IHRA and was doing some other stuff. And the NHRA thing came together for me in 2013 when New England Dragway switched over to NHRA sanction. I had a whole kind of series of events that came together that allowed me to kind of do a tryout, if you will, at the first New England Nationals that they had up there in Epping. And the 2014 season, the Gator Nationals was my first national event for NHRA outside of New England Dragway. And it's been downhill since then. That's the short version.
Right. What's my follow-up question immediately, what is the car your dad is still racing? What type?
So it's a 1970 Nova. So he has two Novas. He's got two 70 Novas, actually. One of them's it's a ladder bar style car. Always had small block engines in it. When we first got it, it was like we had a couple of real mild, you know, cast crank, stroker small blocks in it. And then kind of graduated up from there. When we blow one of those up, we built something a little bit better. And to this point now, he runs that. The car that I drove, he runs it as basically a super street car, like a 1090 index car. It's got a small block in it on alcohol. And then he has a tube chassis car that he has a delay box and stuff in, another 70 Nova that he runs. That car is basically a super pro, you know, super pro style car.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yep. So growing up in Epping, right? Up yep. in that area.
Yeah. I live in the same town I grew up in. So I'm like, I live about 20 minutes south of Boston.
Yeah. So growing up in God's country, you know, that's an awesome racetrack to grow up around. And what are some of the things that you reflect back on back in your growing up days of Epping? Because that place is incredible from the facility standpoint and the history alone.
Yeah, it's neat. It's, you know, for me, when I started working there, like, you know, when I first started going there when I was 16 or 17, we go up and just go to testing two nights and beat on our street cars and stuff like that. And then for me, it's just, it's like home. You know, I remember the very first time I drove myself there when I was like, whatever it was, 17 probably. And it was like driving to the moon, man. It's like, it's an 80 mile drive, but it was like, you know, you're 17 years old, you're driving to New Hampshire. It was like, this is the biggest thing in the world. Oh man. But no, it was super fun. And I look at that place when we go back there for the national event, and as much as it's changed and that, you know, they've updated the lighting and the surface and, you know, done a lot of paving in the pits and they've added some grandstands and stuff, but there's still that little bitty tower that I used to sleep in. I mean, I used to, when I worked there in college, I was sleeping in my truck in the parking lot on the weekends, and the track manager, Joe Lombardo, who still runs the place, like was leaving one night. He says, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm sleeping. You know, I don't want to drive 2.5 hours back to college." So the next weekend, he gave me a key to the gate and a key to the tower. So I would bring a sleeping bag with me and I'd go in there and I'd drive up to the track on Friday after I had class or work at school. And I would sleep in the back room of the tower on Friday night and Saturday night, and then drive back to school on Sunday afternoon after we finished for the day. And the weird thing is, the room that I used to sleep in is now the room they used as the TV booth for the NHRA broadcasts. the room that was my weird kind of ghetto apartment at Epping is now going to be the broadcast booth, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. And, you know, you walk in there and you tell Tony, you know, "Hey, you know, that over there's my spot. This is my room."
Right.
You're my house.
I used to joke because when I first started going up there and kind of working there and stuff, that back room hadn't been remodeled since like the 70s. So there's actually a bar. There was never any liquor in it, but there was like a bar and stuff back there. And it was like, oh, this is my condo. I have a bar. The bathroom's over here. You know, it's like it was this little kind of crummy room. But No, I love that place. I'm sure you guys have those type of places too, where it's just, you know, it's a place you feel at home and you know the people and you kind of like know the nooks and crannies of it. So it's a neat racetrack. You know, it's kind of on an island up there in some ways, way up in New Hampshire. So it's a neat place, and I'm glad that they have a national event. You know, a lot of people, I just say a lot of people, there are people that are like, oh, that track shouldn't have a national event, this and that. And I think, to me, it's one of the most unique events on the tour because the track is comparatively a lot smaller than a lot of the other places. But the feel of it, like when you're up there during that national event, like it feels like you're at Woodstock. It's really cool.
Yep, absolutely. You're known for your voice. You're known one of the most unique voices, the most identifiable voices in drag racing today. But that wasn't your original plan.
No, that wasn't. It wasn't. I was, you know, when I was a kid and everything, and even for a long time, all I wanted to do was just write stuff for car magazines. And so I went to college for it. I got a journalism degree. And, you know, that was what my plan was. My plan was just to write for whatever car magazines would hire me to write for them. And that's what I did for a long time. And I still, you know, freelance for several magazines. But it was at that point in college when we had a motorsports club at University of Massachusetts, and a couple of the guys saw this notice that the SECA had put out for our New England region that they were looking for an announcer. And, you know, we'd always joked around, and I was part of the comedic relief of our group, and like, dude, you should try this. You know, you should try this. And I tried it and I really liked it. I was horrible at it to start with. Like, you are, anybody that does anything for the first time is bad at it, but I felt like,
I was waiting on a Lone's one-liner to follow that, but yeah. It's all right.
Yeah, I felt like it was something that, I knew I was not good at it, but I felt like I could be good at it. And then, you know, in my mind, it was like, man, I really want to do this at a drag strip. Like, that's where this road racing stuff is okay. I know nothing about it, but I do know a lot about drag racing because I've been around it my whole life and I understand it. And the road racing stuff gave me the confidence to contact a guy named Glenn Groh that was running Lebanon Valley Dragway in New York at the time, because it was very close to school, my college where I was going. And so the road racing thing was great, and I had a lot of fun doing it. And by the time I was done, I don't think I was that bad at it, but it was the springboard to give me the confidence to call a drag strip and go, hey, man, I'd like to come and try working for you, doing testing tunes or whatnot. And if you want to hear a crazy story, you'll dig this. I've not told anybody this since it happened. So you're getting fresh material here.
Hold on. Breaking news here. Dialed in. Yes. We're breaking news to the world. L-O-H-N-E-S.
Yeah. Loans. Yeah. So at Pomona this year, so just whatever it was, a month ago, you know, they run the Summit kind of ET championship deal at Pomona, where they have the ET racers from all around the country that have, you know, win the race of champions or win their bracket finals, come out to run. So one of the kids, this guy named Nelson Bilott from Lebanon Valley, is one of the racers that made it and actually ended up winning the race in his particular category. But anyway, I knew he was there. He's from New York. So I wanted to find him in the pits on Thursday or Friday and just say hello to him and congratulate him and ask him how their trip out was and stuff. So I'm walking up to his car, and there's a guy, it's him and his buddies, and there's a guy sitting there, and I'm walking up and I'm kind of looking at him, and you see people sometimes, and obviously I deal with a lot of people, but I'm looking at this guy, I'm like, I know this guy from somewhere, but I couldn't place it. So he looks at me and he says, you don't remember who I am? And I said, no. And I said, I want to say your name might be Phil. And he said, it is. And then it was like my heart, like it, this guy was the very first person I ever announced anything with at a drag strip at Lebanon Valley Dragway. My very first day ever announcing at a drag strip at Lebanon Valley, it was me and this guy, Phil, doing this tested tune. And
that's awesome.
It was, and I had not seen this guy. I mean, I hadn't seen this guy in probably 15 years, you know. It was like, but to have it happen on that weekend and knowing what was coming the following week with the announcement and stuff, it was like this crazy kind of closing of the loop, you know. It was neat.
And you didn't pull any strings and get him up in the booth for a couple of laps?
No. And I actually said, hey, you want to come up? And he's like, no. He said, he was like, man, I'm out here to drink beer and have fun and hang out in California and be out of New York. And I was like, that's cool. No, he was just chilling. And it was a neat moment just to see that guy, because I hadn't seen him, like I said, like over a decade. It was cool.
Yeah. I'm here to drink beer also. And I just turned inside out.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, that's an awesome story. Yeah, and I listened to Nelson's interview with Luke and Jed, and that was a pretty cool story that they had going on. And they had 15 people from New York and California. That's a That's no easy way to get there.
No, it's crazy. And they said it was 2,800. It was like 2,828 miles. I think when I calculated like from Lebanon Valley Dragway to Pomona, it's like 2,828 miles. Like it's an insane. I mean, that's a trip. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's a long way. Kind of just did the opposite. He went the lazy route, which I completely applaud that.
Right. Yeah, this is way less effort. Yeah, exactly.
Well, as I can see and hear, well, not really see, definitely hear with the voice, definitely have the announcer and TV voice going for you, Brian. And then as far as the questions I have prepared, wanted to ask you, what is your favorite class in drag racing to watch and why?
That's a good one. I would say my favorite class in drag racing to watch at this point is probably Radio versus the World. If I had to pick one of all the different stuff that I do, I would put it at Radio versus the World because of it is to me at this point, at this moment in drag racing, the most performance wise unpredictable thing that exists. The rule book is the thinnest, you know, in terms of a class that's really like really high performance. It's the rule book is super thin. There are still, in my opinion, performance barriers that are going to be broken that haven't been broken yet. And it's, you know, just like, I mean, it's the equivalent of what the funny cars were from, say, 65 through 69. Like when you watch the funny cars go from these ultra wheelbase AFX cars and then all of a sudden Mercury comes out with the flip top cars and everything was advancing at such a rapid rate. I feel like Radio versus the World is kind of in that period. And maybe we're getting towards the end of that period. But to me, you know, that's the class that has matured in a really crazy way. And, you know, you go to Donald's races and especially like Sweet 16, you go there and it's just every guy shows up and they all have a pile of spare parts and they're not afraid to use them. So that's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely unpredictable. That's why the cars are, you know, sometimes taking flight and crossing lanes. And it's definitely must-see TV when Radio versus the World is on. I agree 100%.
Yeah, and I think the other thing too, I mean, a lot of the stuff's hidden from the naked eye, but I think the Radio versus World cars encapsulate a level of technology that only exists in their particular category. I think when you look at all the stuff those guys are doing, whether we're talking about suspension or even electronic stuff with the traction control and wheelie control and stuff like that, you know, you're incorporating a lot of stuff that maybe isn't evident from the outside of the car, but is really cutting edge all over the place. I mean, I think the majority of drag racing fans maybe don't understand that, you know, those are $250,000 or $350,000 cars that are rolling down the racetrack. I mean, there is a pile of money invested in every one of those things. So it's cool.
Yep, absolutely. And that's a testament to, I think it was Stevie that kicked the rods out the spring race last year, right? That swapped engines to get it through, or maybe it was.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. And then Haney had the whole deal where it was shearing off the bolts. It was sheared off all the bolts off of the flywheel. Like there was like, there was legitimate full on thrashing going on. So
what did Woody do a few years ago? Something about the piston, it melted a piston or something, didn't it? And they were on a mad thrash at Woody Mart to get that thing put back together.
Yeah. I think he put at least one piston out of the thing and they, you know, and there was, you know, like always happens, which is a great thing about drag racing. There was, you know, 46 people ran over there to help him. You know, there was more, there were so many people packed into that tiny space. But yeah, I mean, it's a really hardcore form of racing. And, you know, those cars I think are interesting too, because they run sparingly. You know, those guys don't run a lot during the summer months. The really super hardcore serious guys don't, because the conditions aren't there. And you're going to run a radial car in 130, 40 degree racetrack. It's not going to run the big number. So there is a home run derby element to that class that I think is interesting too, where, you know, there are guys that I think are more happy to set a record than they are even to win a race at some level. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but, you know, the approach is different, I think, for everybody. But it's to me, it's electrifying. And there's a lot of stuff in drag racing that's electrifying. But those particular cars, to me, at this point, with the different styles of chassis, all the different bodies, all the different engine combinations, it's the Wild West still.
What do you think NHRA could learn from that?
I think it could learn, you know what I think it could learn? It could learn a part of the showmanship of that class. And what I think is interesting about it is the showmanship part of the class doesn't necessarily take place on the racetrack, which is almost counterintuitive. But, you know this as well as I do, leading up to all those radial races, it's the 5 or 6 weeks before everybody is, you know, everybody's flinging poo at each other and everybody's saying this, that, everything. Like, there's an element of that you can't make up. You know what I mean? Like, you can't force that. That has to happen. But in that world, or in that class in particular, that's part of the game, right? Part of the game is either bragging on your stuff or taking a shot at somebody or throwing some money up and saying, you know, come on and qualifying and get a piece of this. I think there's an element of that that NHRA should embrace. You know what I mean?
Yep, absolutely. And sorry, I got distracted for a second. Jenna just tried to melt herself lighting the gas fireplace.
This place, I didn't hear an explosion, so you guys were okay. Yeah.
It went woof. So Rockingham 2006, what do you remember most about that day?
Rockingham in 2006 for the IHRA race?
The first national that you got to announce. You know, yeah. I remember my first race, and I remember distinctly a lot of moments that happened. But
So I got a couple stories of that day. The first one is I failed to ask a critical question before I went to the event, which was, what color pants do I bring? Now, it would seem very simple that you would just bring black pants. Well, at the time, I was like super, like trying to do the right thing and everything. So I just slipped my mind. So I packed tan pants or whatever. So I was the only guy in an IHRA shirt and tan pants the whole weekend. But I remedied that before the next weekend. But I remember the very first starting line interview I ever did at any sort of national event, even counting Epping, because I never did that stuff there before Rockingham, was with Annette Summer. Annette was running her and Vern had the turbocharged Corvette that they were working on and they had worked on for years. And I interviewed her at the starting line. And it was like the coolest thing ever because it was Annette Summer and I never met her in person. And, you know, from her days of the pink Camaro and everything else, it was pretty awesome. I remember talking to Bruce Litton at the top end one session. I remember being just nervous as hell that I was going to screw the whole thing up. And I remember... there was a guy that was trying to scam money out of us coming into the hotel. This is pretty funny, actually. We got back to the hotel one night. God only knows what the hell time it was, but we get back to the hotel and this guy walks up and he says, "Oh man, I missed my bus and I need a couple of bucks and blah blah blah." And the guy was Brian Olson, who I was with. And Brian looks at him and says, "What time was the bus supposed to come?" And the guy immediately screwed up the whole, you know, his story went off the rails and he had to answer any questions. So we just kind of blew him off. But yeah, I remember the whole experience and I remember just loving it. You know, I remember like leaving to fly home that weekend, just being like, oh man, this is it. You know, this is exactly what I want to do.
Yeah. Your starting line with Annette, probably good that you didn't choose to wear sweatpants as a young aspiring announcer.
Right. Never the right move ever. Yeah.
So Brian, Jake kind of started us a little bit down this path with the NHRA talk, and I wanted to ask, and this is a subject that Jake and I dove into a couple episodes ago, I believe. So pro stock, I know that we were kind of saying, okay, how do we save it? You know, what is maybe the answer there? Is the class dying? And I read some things this week, some talk about it, like, you know, we shouldn't be talking like, okay, it's going away, because it's not going away. It's still here. There's a chance to bring it back, you know, so that's what I want to start talking about is how do we, or maybe what are some ideas or anything, you know, off the top of your head, I guess, how do we get pro stock steered back in the right direction to restore it to its former glory?
To me, you know, one of the major things is, for me anyway, is like when I was growing up, guys that were really good sportsman racers all wanted to go become pro stock racers, right? If you were a really good sportsman racer, like that was what you wanted to do. But what are we seeing now? We're seeing people that are really good sportsman racers, young people that have the means or the wherewithal to do it. We're seeing a lot of those young sportsman racers go into A-fuel cars or go into top sportsman, top dragster cars and kind of finding their spot there. So you need to have a path, right? Everybody's looking at what's happening in the moment. Everybody's looking like right now, like, okay, we're going to have 18 races. Are we going to have 16 cars at the 18 races? But like, my opinion is that the focus, if you're really going to make a concerted long-term effort with pro stock, the effort needs to look not what's happening now, but what's going to happen in 3 or 4 or 5 years. Because unless you have people that want to come up and do this, whatever you're doing now is a temporary solution that doesn't matter. Not that that doesn't matter. You want to give people a format to race under. But the reality is, unless you have people coming to move into the pro stock category up a ladder of some sort or from whatever direction, then you really don't have a long-term solution for the class. So, you know, for me, the question is, you know, if I if you spot talent or you spot people who are super talented sportsman racers, I think the questions like are, do you want to race? You know, you need to figure out if people still want to do this, right? You need to figure out if, is it still the path that a lot of people want to go down? You know, the Dave Conleys of the world, like you can use Dave as a great example of a guy who's just an absolutely murderously great sportsman racer who got in a pro stock car and was great. I mean, the guy is a killer driver, killer tuner, obviously insanely talented. So there has to be more Dave Conleys out there that want to come up and run pro stock. So when you identify the people that want to do it, then you have to identify how they can do it. But to me, the big thing is you need to have a long-term view of the situation, and you need to figure out, are there still enough people that see pro stock as a path to take to be a professional racer? Or has the path deviated to the point where anybody that wants to really try to make it in the game wants to run a fuel car? You know, that's what, to me, that's the real thing you got to figure out.
Yeah. And I think I had this thought a while back that, you know, NHRA wants to keep these limitations and whatnot and try to keep costs down on pro stock. I don't know why they would not. I understand it's a lot of money for a startup, but a pilot program that, you know, hey, this is NHRA's house car and you are the division, you're the super pro national champion, you have a shot at this for X amount of races or something along those lines. That would be an incredible way to get to it. I know it's probably a far out concept, but you know, to show that talent is there, the money just needs to come with it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a cool idea. I think you'd have to modify it to some degree where NHRA would not have their, you know, you would take NHRA away from the car, but you would build a program. Like NHRA would build a program that says, okay, your concept is cool. I like that idea. Like you are the national champion of, you know, you're a sportsman national champion, throw everybody's name in a hat, draw the name out, and you get to run four races in a pro stocker next year through one of the teams, but NHRA has built some sort of a package to do it. That would be a really cool kind of dream come true type of thing for somebody. And that's neat.
It's a far out idea.
It is. Well, but you know, at the end of the day is at this point, the only type of ideas that you need to be talking about, in my opinion, with pro stock are the far out ideas, right? Because the normal ideas, we played out normal ideas for almost 50 years now. You know, starting in 1970, we've played out pretty much every idea we could since 1970. So let's start getting weird.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, memberships aren't getting any cheaper and the payouts aren't getting any higher for the national champions and whatnot. So I feel like that would be a good way to say, hey, you know, thank you. This is our incentive for being a bracket ET member of our NHRA division. So I don't know. I'm sure nobody will ever hear this that matters other than yourself and a few other people, but you know, that'd be an awesome idea to just see what it would take to get to that.
It'd be really cool. I mean, to me, that's a really neat concept to talk about and a neat concept to try to build something off of. That's neat.
So Bang Shift 2008, you and the Bearded Wonder.
Yes. Me and Chad. Yeah.
And Neil Sabo was in there for a few, right?
Yeah. Neil's been around since day one. Neil was like one of our message board guys, and Neil has been like
infidel.
He's been like an indispensable right hand man. Like he's helped us out on so many like on live broadcasts and stuff over the years. Like Neil's a really good dude.
So what brought you and Chad to form that? You know, I obviously there was a huge desire for content in the racing world, but what was the final get together of, hey, let's do this?
So I met Chad. So the whole thing really starts in 2005. So I met Chad in 2005 on Hot Rod Magazine Drag Week on the very first one of those. He was there actually racing a car. He is a 56 Chevy station wagon that's on.
Oh, yeah.
That's on a Caprice chassis. He's got the car called Rusty, and he was racing Rusty there. And so I was there covering the event from for competitionplus.com. I was working for Bobby at the time. And so I met him on that. And so Bang Shift started as the result of the failure of another website. So David Freiberger and Chad were part of a website called Car Junkie TV that started in 2007, which was like a super cool, very video heavy, kind of ahead of its time, video based website, all types of video car content. And I was one of their news bloggers. And I was working a regular job at the time, but I'd go home at night and crank out content for them. And we all know what happened in 2008. The bottom fell out of the economy. And when that happened,
I'm not so sure. I was in eighth grade, sir.
Yeah, okay. So 2008, The economy collapses and we go into the, you know, the Great Recession, quote unquote, but their venture capital money that was funding that website just went away. So Car Junkie TV goes bankrupt. The only asset that was left out of the company was like they had this message board with like 2,500 members. Neil Sabo was one of them. And we took that message board and started a website called Freiberger's Junkyard, which was me, David, and Chad. And then David got his job back at Hot Rod Magazine. We had to change the name of the website. So we changed the name to Bankshift. And then, you know, David went back to work at Hot Rod and Chad and I took Bankshift and off we went. So that's how the whole thing kind of came together. It was kind of an act. It was accidental. You know, it was a kind of a get together after their deal failed because the money went away. And we kind of, instead of going from the top down, we kind of rebuilt it from the bottom up and made it into what it is, I guess.
Yeah. And that was 2008. And, you know, at that time, it would, in your professional life, that would Bankshift, I feel like, would be the presumed, you know, angel on one ear and devil in the other. That was kind of pushing you away from your professional career, your full-time job. And that would eventually lead you to probably what is the hardest times of your professional career that came out to be probably the greatest experience of all. So you left IHRA in 2011. And what were your motives behind that? If it's not pushing too far.
It's fine. By the time we got to 2011, the IHRA, they, like every other racing organization, was trying to figure out a way to survive. And it had gone from some really, in my opinion, some of the best racing in the last 25 years when at the height of IHRA in the early mid 2000s, it was unbelievable, man. We were having great shows, had huge crowds, everything was cool. Then the economy collapsed and the Evan Knoll thing happened and a lot of stuff kind of went sideways. So by the time we got to 2011, we were, you know, it was a pretty decent pro mod show. It was some booked in fuel cars. It was like, it was just kind of a traveling match race series and there was nothing wrong with it, but I wasn't as into it as I felt like I wanted to be. And if I was going to go out there and do the job, I didn't want to be half-assing it. And not that I was, but I didn't want to get to a point where I wasn't enjoying myself. So I pulled the plug on that after that season, just because it was kind of like, you know, I've kind of done what I needed to do here. I've proved that I can do this on this level. And I pretty much figured at that point that was going to be it. Like I thought, I've been able to announce national events. I've been able to announce Top Fuel cars and Nitro Funny cars and see all kinds of crazy stuff and travel around the United States and Canada. And if this is the height of everything I've ever done, I'm cool with it. So I went back to just working at New England Dragway and doing some stuff regionally up here in the New England region. And, you know, I never, as much as I wanted to, I never thought that I would ever do anything with NHRA because I never had the chance. I never interacted with any NHRA people. I was never at a place where there was national events. You know, no one, it's not like they were, you know, sending talent scouts around the country. No one knew that, you know, no one was coming to Epping to see how I was doing up there. So I was just kind of settled into my role and Bankshift had gained steam. And in November of 2011, my full-time job wanted me to transfer to another place that was way away from my house. And I didn't want to do that. So I left the full-time job and with the blessing of my wife and we had a little baby and all kinds of other stuff left and tried to make a full pull out of Bankshift and freelancing and it actually worked. It didn't look like it was going to for a while, but it actually did. So,
yeah. And I'm sure, you know, there's probably some pretty rough times in between 12 and 15, but 2015 rolled around in Gainesville and that had to be a pretty big relief because, you know, I've been to the local bracket finals here in Division III. And I actually was fortunate enough to get a little bit of mic time. A good friend of mine, Nick Agresta. I'm not sure if you know Nick or not.
I've certainly heard of Nick. I've never met Nick in person, but I've heard his name. Yes.
Yep. But him and Dennis Weiniger. And Dennis was, he said, you know, hey, you know, come here and talk for an hour or so and we'll see how you do. And maybe you can be a part of the guild, which was pretty cool experience. But it's pretty intimidating because all those guys in there think that you're coming to take their job. You know, they're obviously, most of them are the older generation, and it's pretty intimidating to go in there and try to do your own thing whenever you know they're over your shoulder the whole time.
Yeah, it's the one thing I had going for me, I think, going into Gainesville was that I had been doing this for long enough to know and had done it, like, not at an NHRA national event level, but had done it on the IHRA national event level when that meant something, you know, when we would go to Norwalk with IHRA and fill the place, you know, when we would go to some of these tracks and blow them out. It was like, we weren't just doing we weren't just doing small shows. So like, I wasn't intimidated by the environment, but there was a level of kind of like, you're going in there, like, you know, no one really knows who you are. People are kind of like waiting for you to step on a banana peel or whatever. But, the moment that I'll never forget at Gainesville and that first race was, I'm sitting there and we're going through the sportsman categories and everything. And I'm kind of looking down at the schedule and we're getting closer to the first Pro Mod qualifying session. And I'm thinking, oh man, like I wanted to do the Pro Mod so bad because, you know, they were a centerpiece of IHRA for so many years. And I knew so many of the guys and it was like, I really wanted to do it, but I figured one of the other guys that's been around for a while is going to want to do it. So I'll get bumped back and that's fine. I wasn't going to be angry about it, but I was just in my back of my head. I'm thinking, oh, I would love to do this first, you know, qualifying session of Pro Mod. So as the Pro Mods are getting ready to pull around the corner, the other guys look around the room, look at each other, and they look at me and they go,
we don't want to do this.
Exactly. And they said, do you want to do this? I said, oh, you better believe I want to do this. I said, get out of my way. And,
yeah, go get a hot dog.
Yeah. And that was like a cool thing because I was like, wow, so this is a thing. This is a thing I can kind of like, this is my little foothold here. I can make these Pro Mod guys kind of my foothold. And I had been at the test session. It was kind of like I cheated on the test. I had actually been down at the test session that they had that particular year that they ran at Palm Beach. So when these guys are coming around the corner, I was like, you know, oh man, 2 weeks ago, this guy was running, you know, whatever. He was running 590s at the time, blah, blah, blah. And then I remember Steve Matuzik from Aeromotive. I was walking through the pits and he said, are you the guy that was up there? I said, yeah. He's like, how do you know I was doing this, that, and the other thing? I said, well, I was there. And he said, oh man, okay. So it was like, it was neat. The pieces all fell together.
That's when they started turning the clocks off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, Brian, what year did you start doing the Lights Out broadcast? And how does that marathon compare to like a U.S. Nationals week and a half?
So yeah, I can tell you Lights Out compares to nothing I've ever done or probably will.
I feel so bad for you guys because I know what talking for 40 straight is like, but I couldn't imagine.
The sickness of it for me is that that is the type of thing. Like to me, those are the races I look most forward to. Like Indy Lights Out, No Mercy, the Sweet 16, like that to me, like those are the races that I really, really look forward to because you're going to see stuff there. You're going to see stories develop over the course of that time. So for instance, if we're just going to talk about Lights Out, you know, to me, Lights Out is unique in the sense that you are in an environment at that race that there's not an environment like that at any other drag race in the country in terms of just how everybody's so packed in and it's crazy. And there's people screaming and yelling and there's 300 people in the tower and there's like chickens and goats walking through the tower. I mean, who knows what's going on? Like at any moment, you have no idea what's happening. So I like that, you know, that element of Lights Out is to me kind of interesting. It's the type of old school chaos that old guys talk about. You know, it's the, oh man, I was at Lions at the last drag race and it was crazy. There was too many people there. It was all, everybody was up, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, that's Lights Out. You know, like these guys want to tell these stories from 1973 and how everything was cooler then and how everything was way better then. Wrong. You know, that Lights Out is everything, everything that those guys are talking about. Lights Out is that plus 150%. So a race like Lights Out and a race like the U.S. Nationals, what they have in common to me is that you get to tell a really complete story over the course of those races. You get to see teams that are at the very beginning of the event, probably struggling or trying to figure out what they're doing. Or you see teams that are killing it to start with and then run into problems and have to put their stuff back together. So unlike a normal 3-day event that you don't normally have that extended period, when you get into these long races, you get to see these really neat stories develop and play themselves out over a weekend. And that's my favorite thing.
Yep, absolutely.
I know that Brian is a drag racing history buff for sure. If you could interview any racer living or who has passed on, who would it be and why?
I would be Art Arfons. He's dead.
Nice.
And that's the reason.
Never heard of him.
He's died. But he, to me, you know, everybody talks about Mickey Thompson. You know, Mickey Thompson's like the greatest hot rodder that ever lived and stuff. And I have obviously a ton of respect for everything that Mickey Thompson accomplished. But I think if we're going to talk about what hot rodding is in terms of, you know, taking the things that you have around you or your own two hands and making something, I think Art Arfons, you know, a guy went 576 miles an hour with a car that he built out of, you know, basically old tractor parts and sheet metal that he had in his shop and a jet engine that he bought out of a scrapyard. You know, this is a guy that, you know, then he went and was a dominant tractor puller, you know, Art Alphonse, when we talk about the impact that that guy had on drag racing, you know, you're talking about the guy that effectively invented the jet dragster. And, you know, jet dragsters, whether you love them or hate them, jet dragsters have put more people in seats at drag strips over the last 50 years than any single other thing that's ever been created. You know, there are places that still that there are tracks that stay in business now because they run a couple of jet car shows a year that draw enough people for them to pay their bills and open the gate the next year. So I'd love to talk to Art Alphonse because of the fact that he's had a very long lasting impact on drag racing. And because I think the guy is one of the coolest, most fearless hot rodders that's ever lived.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I remember, you know, when I was a tiny kid, we lived in the Northeast. I was born in New Jersey. We moved to Indiana when I was 8. So I spent time as a small kid at Old Bridge Township and races there. That was our closest drag strip. And I remember seeing Art Alphonse in the jet dragster. I saw him pull tractors.
Cool.
There was one, the Dragon Lady as well.
His daughter. That was his daughter, Dusty. Yeah, Dusty Alphonse. Yeah.
That was awesome. They put on a heck of a show, and it would have not only the turban, you know, shooting the fire out of the tractor, but they had lights on them. I mean, as a kid, I was mesmerized. So yeah, that's a great answer. I hadn't thought about Art Alphonse for a while.
Cool.
You guys just had a moment right there.
Mm-hmm,
I like that. No, it felt good. I like it. Mm-hmm.
So is it about time top sportsmen and top dragster have their spot at the U.S. Nationals?
Man, that was the coolest thing ever. I was super happy when I saw, not only when I saw him on the kind of registration page, but when I saw the fact that it wasn't a typo. I thought that was great.
What's the bump?
Oh God. That's more of a tricky question than you think, but I think conservatively probably I'm gonna pray that we have a cool Indy, like not like a million degree, like 100-degree job like we had this year. So I'm gonna say the bump's a 30.
Yeah, and there's gonna be a lot of 99 passes, I think.
I agree. And you know what's interesting is they always kind of tweak those, especially at the U.S. Nationals, they always tweak the quotas, if you will, in the weeks kind of coming up to the race. So it's gonna be interesting to see where it actually ends up, like how many cars they allow in. That'll obviously have an effect on the bump spot. You know, if the more cars they allow in, the harder people are going to push their stuff. So it'll be interesting to see where it ends up. But if the bump spot's any slower than a 35, I'd be shocked.
I'd be disappointed completely. And I think we can see, you know, lower than 60s in top sportsmen even.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, obviously Division III is like, to me, I know the guys in Texas are pretty fast, but Division III is obviously where it's at in terms of just ridiculous, you know, take no prisoners performance in those categories. So you're going to have races from all over the country there, but I think you're going to have a preponderance of Division III people there, and those guys don't screw around. So that should be fun.
I was looking at the Facebook page earlier, and I gotta get more with the times, but all the stuff that you're in, man, and this 3K Hoopty challenge. Looks amazing. I just didn't know if you could kind of talk about what all that entails. I mean, I know obviously I kind of get it, the 3K to spend on the car, but what does the competition all entail?
So it's so it's called the 3K Hoopty Challenge. It actually debuts. We're talking here on December 3rd, so it debuts at 9 p.m. Pacific time on Facebook Watch tonight. So, we joked about this before, but it's like, you know, the people in, you know, Micronesia in Australia get the jump on this because it'll be the middle of the morning for them. And it's going to be late for everybody else. But, you know, the show is going to be there. You can find it on Facebook at the 3K Hoopty Challenge. But the show is really, this concept is very simple. Show up with a car that you built yourself that you claim is worth less than $3,000. We have five classes. We have a LS swaps, junkyard turbos, truck and motorhome, or truck and van, which also includes motorhomes. We have those show up. We had a class called nitrous bombs, and we had a class called Frankensteins. And so it is a six episode series. The six episodes are those five classes, and then a six all star episode where the winners of those five classes all run off. But basically, the concept is this: you show up with your car, you say this is worth less than $3,000, it qualifies for one of those classes, and then me and Freiberger look at it and determine whether we believe it's worth less than $3,000 or not. If it is, or if we decide to pick it, we each pick teams. If you get picked to be on our team, then you race, and the winner of the race gets paid $3,000, and then the winner of the All-Star episode got an additional $3,000 as well. So, I mean, we had some of the most horrendous cars you've ever seen in your life show up to this thing. Now, all of them had to pass. Anybody that raced had to pass NHRA Tech. We shot at a Tucson Dragway. We had NHRA people there. You know, the stuff that raced was not fast, but it did all have to pass Tech. And it's super fun. Like, you know, we told all the competitors, like, listen, like, make sure that you brought your sense of humor. We're here to have fun. We're not going to walk up and be like, oh, man, this car is awesome. Like, we're not going to say that.
Right.
You're going to pick out the most glaring flaws your car has.
How did that thing make it 60 feet, let alone 13-20?
Right. And, you know, you'll see the shows, but, like, some of the stuff's genius. Like, a guy showed up with a legitimate taxi cab that he had bought from an auction that he put a 250-horse shot of nitrous to. Like, it was an old Crown Victoria with, like, 490,000 miles on it. It still had the taxi sign on the roof. He made these little crappy bullhorns out of like 2.5-inch exhaust pipe that came out around the fenders, and he put all the nitrous in the world to it. We had guys there. We had a guy with a Gremlin that had a 500 cubic inch junkyard Cadillac motor put in it. The motorhome guy was like a 74 Chevy motorhome that had a 400 small block with iron heads and a bunch of nitrous to it. Like, it, the show is really fun. The stuff that people showed up with is awesome. And if enough people watch this thing, we'll be able to do a series. The contract that Freiberg and I have with Facebook is, you know, they have an option to make 4 seasons of the show, assuming anybody watches it. So we may never do another one if nobody watches it, but if people do, we'll get to do another one. So it'll be cool. I really think you guys will dig it. I mean, the shows are really fun. You know, it is a fun show, and it has all the fun, weird twists and turns you'd expect out of any sort of drag racing thing.
So, yeah, so it looks awesome. Tomorrow is going to be the highest turnover rate in Facebook TV history, right? When it comes to people watching it work.
Right.
The job market is going to completely drop out tomorrow.
We want the productivity of America to just hit the skids tomorrow. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. We want everybody to, you know, all 6 episodes drop at once. So it's a, you know, you can binge watch it while you're, you know, while you flip your boss off, you can sit there and just watch all 6 episodes. And they're like, 25 minutes a piece. So you could be done with this whole thing before lunchtime.
Well, I can promise you I won't be flipping my box off, but, what racetrack as the best food you've ever been, what racetrack do you look forward to going to because of the food? Cause I know you're a foodie and a beverage guy. So let's hear, because, you know, obviously you've got the food trucks everywhere, but I'm talking like hardcore racetrack concession stand. Who's got it?
I got to think on this for a second because there's a lot of good stuff floating around out there. So back in the day, which I think, I don't know if they still do. I don't think they do anymore. Back in the day, when Virginia was a IHRA track, they used to have fried bologna sandwiches that were pretty sweet. That was good. I'm trying to think of right now, like, what my favorite racetrack delicacy is at this point. You know what? You can get pork butt on a stick at Indy. That's pretty good.
Yes, you can.
Get a big hunk of pork with a wooden rod jammed through it. That's always not something you can get everywhere. Oh man, it's funny because a lot of the small tracks around the country are cool because the concession stands, like the food's like scratch made. You know, like the lady who runs the concession stands like cooking at her house all day and bringing the stuff to sell out of the stand. So that's always pretty good.
Have you ever had Scrapple?
I have had Scrapple in New Jersey. Yeah.
Oh man, you East Coast guys are something else, man.
Yeah, if you eat too much of that stuff, you'll be dead by the time you're 40 if you eat too much of that stuff, though. You don't want to make a habit out of that.
Yeah, yeah. A friend of mine, George Hoff, brought me some up. I was announcing, I don't know where, I forget. I think Carolina Dragway.
Okay.
And he brought some up with syrup. And I was like, eh, that's pretty good. What is it? And he said, oh, it's a fried pig brain.
Right. It is everything you never wanted to eat ever, all jammed up into a patty and then fried. Yeah.
Nice. What's the greatest or best race car name you've ever seen or heard of, in your opinion?
Oh man, there's a bunch of those. There was a guy at Epping that had a car called Dilligaff. Do you know what Dilligaff means?
Yeah. Do I look like I give a?
Exactly. Yeah. I thought that, and I didn't know what Dilligaff meant till I asked the guy. I'm like, what does this mean? You know, he told me. I saw a car one time named That Damn Thing, which I thought was pretty great. You know, you lose That Damn Thing beat me. You know, it was pretty good. Race car names to me are great, and it's a lost art, man. Race car names are a total lost art. There are so few people that actually name a race car anymore. It's kind of that is a crappy thing in and unto itself. Race cars should have names. That's why, like, when Jeremy Ray was, you know, won and running well last year in NHRA Pro Mod, it was awesome. Carolina Kingpin, it's always a fun thing when you can call a car out by name rather than just, oh, it's an orange Corvette, you know, type of thing. But, Yeah, those are two good ones. Dylan Gaff will probably always be my favorite because I remember I never in a million years would have expected that answer when I asked the guy what it meant.
That's awesome. So Donald Long has taken promoting to an incredible level. He has cojones. He doesn't care. And he has brought incredible light and made Radio Versus the World. And he is, yeah. You said that they've got the thinnest rule book. That's because the Bruder brothers haven't ran it yet. But so what can you tell us about Donald that most people don't know? Because, you're not retiring. You know, he's
oh my God,
obviously, yeah. obviously using that because that attracts a lot of attention saying Loans is done. Because then you're stuck with what? Lee Sebring and what's the no time guy? Oh, Willie Dog.
Willie Dog. Yeah. You know, I think the one thing that people would not expect out of Donald is away from the racetrack and away from Facebook. Donald is the type of guy that will call you up and be like, "Hey, man, how you doing?" He's a very good guy. He's a good friend. He's the type of guy that is like legitimately like, "Hey, man, I hope everything's good. Just calling to say hello, kind of to catch up, blah blah blah." You know, he's certainly full throttle when it comes to all the racing stuff and certainly, you know, off the wall when it comes to a lot of the promotional stuff. But in terms of just being a guy, really good dude. And, you know, he's also I look at a lot of that stuff. He posted the picture yesterday of the guy that was kind of dressed like him. I don't know if you saw that. He posted a photo on his Facebook.
Yeah,
it's just imposter. Well, I sent him that photo. So I took the photo of the guy from the window at Bradenton. I said, "I don't know who this dude is, man, but he's stealing your look." And then he grabbed it and, of course, you know, immediately posted it on social media. But he's a funny guy, and he's a guy that is very concerned. You know, a lot of people are like, "Oh, he's only doing this for the money and this and that." And obviously his races are profitable. But I can tell you as a guy who works on the inside of those races that he is a guy that is very concerned in a good way with making sure that people are treated fairly, that have a good experience, that are not screwed over at any point in the race. And like at any event, there are moments that happen and you got to make decisions and this and that. But I can tell you for point of fact, because I've been standing there watching him make decisions or having conversations, that he's always trying to do the right thing by the racer.
Yeah. And I've the first lights I've ever attended, I was sitting there on the, the VIP. Oh, anyway. Yeah. Lee called Radio Versus the World to the lanes, which he does all the time. His old PT, he didn't do the PTC and okay. Donald, you know, hey, they paid good money for that. So and that to me shows that Donald will absolutely take care of you, but at the same time, he will not let the sponsor dollar slip.
No, and you know, I think it's trying to do the right thing by the people that are, you know, paying him to be a part of the race, is to try to do the right thing by the people that are competing on the racetrack, and it's trying to do the right thing by the people that are actually are inside the racetrack. And, you know, he takes that stuff real serious. You know, when you're at the event, he is a guy that's, you know, he's going 100 miles an hour in 20 different directions, but it's because he's trying to make sure everybody's happy with everything. And it's an impossible task to make every single person happy, but I think he succeeds over the vast majority of people.
Yep, absolutely. So, Brian, Traveling Bacon. Where is Traveling Bacon, and how many racetracks have you and/or Traveling Bacon been to? I know the count was well into the 160s last I checked, I believe.
Yeah, still I think 164 is the number right now of racetracks that I've been to. Traveling Bacon has been to, I think he's probably, I don't know, hell, he's been to probably 80 or 90 of them at this point. He's in my backpack as we speak. He's about, I guess, 4 feet tall, sitting in my backpack, but. Yeah, I've slacked off. I got to get back on the Traveling Bacon horse. I've taken some photos of him this year, but it's a funny thing because I, you know, you're trying to do something creative or whatever, and there are some Sunday afternoons and I'm getting ready to leave the racetrack and I'm like, oh, I should probably do this. I'm like, and I should probably just get the hell out of here too. So
trespassing is a real thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the other thing too. If you're sneaking onto someone's property, taking a picture with a weird plastic piece of bacon, that's, you know, you're not doing yourself any favors there either. Yeah,
no, absolutely not. And I know you're a racetrack historian of some sorts, and I know that you had a count. There was 62 racetracks in North Carolina. Is that right?
At one point, yeah, and I think there are still, I think at this point there are still at least in somewhere in the mid 50s of drag strips in North Carolina that are still operating, and some of these places are, you know, as big as your driveway, but they're there. And, yep. You know, people want to get caught up with how many tracks NHRA has or IHRA has, and that's fine. But, if you even if you just go with the NHRA and IHRA combined, you're talking about over 220 racetracks of sanction in the country. And then if you go to unsanctioned tracks, there's hundreds and hundreds of drag strips in this country. And some dumbass guy on Facebook, I commented on something and he got up in my business and I was like, dude, there are more tracks operating now than there were in the late 60s. And the guy like was trying to like laugh me out of the room, but it's a fact. You know, these are factual statements. Like, I'm not going to go out there and just run my mouth on something that is wrong, but there are more drag strips at this second operating right now than there were in the late 60s in this country. Now, there are places like in Southern California that had a ton of tracks that don't have as many as they did because urban sprawl and everything else has put places out of business. But there are other places in the country like the Carolinas, like the Midwest, that have an incredible number of racetracks. Like, you go to the Boot Heel of Missouri, there are multiple racetracks within a 20-mile radius of each other. It's insane.
Yeah. And what would be one racetrack you would resurrect if you could?
Ooh, one I would resurrect if I could.
I know you're a historian and I know you, you document these lost tracks. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of like, I mean, I've been to a, like the closed tracks are pretty amazing. A lot of the closed tracks are like you just walk around and it's like you can, you know, kind of see and feel the history. I want to say, you know what, there was a track called Louisa County Dragway that we visited. I actually visited that with my wife and kids, and it was in the middle, or basically in the middle of a farmer's field now. The farm had kind of swallowed. The racetrack got too short for the time period. The cars got too fast, so they closed it. The farmer bought the land, so his farm has completely surrounded this field, or the field is completely surrounded the track, so you have to kind of walk halfway through his farm to get there to see the racetrack. But that would probably be one I'd resurrect, because it's a really neat location. Neat place. And in theory, if you could change the direction of the track, you could still run it because there's nobody around. It's not like it's a noise place.
Absolutely. So, Brian, it's been incredible talking with you. This conversation has been awesome. In 2011, you sang "Oh Canada" for the IHRA. did that have anything to do with you wanting to quit?
It did not. No, I love Canada. I love their national anthem. That did not drive me to. That did not drive me to quit. No, oh, that's funny as hell. No, I. Yeah. It was not. It was not O Canada. That was the breaking point there.
Yeah, I've been to Canada like way more than I've wanted to in the last couple months for the. I don't know if you've met the Angers twins on all your tours up north, but been up there with them for the last couple of weeks.
Oh, cool.
So the guy better known as the guy that announces with Lee Sebring, we thank you a lot.
Thank you, and, sir. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Looking forward to the 3K Hoopty Challenge coming up. And Put Up or Shut Up is also an awesome show to watch. So thank you from myself for all you do for our sport. And I know it's tiresome effort that doesn't go unnoticed.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on. And looking forward to the Hoopty Challenge and PRI and then getting things rolling here in Pomona in, about 10 weeks.
Off season, says who?
You're right. Thanks, fellas.
Thank you so much, Brian. We appreciate it. And the best of luck to you and everything you do, buddy.
All right, boys. Thank you.
See you alone.
See ya.
So, Zach, our In Motion Solutions final round discussion is going to be one that was poked and prodded by Mr. Michael Beard, a Loose Rocker, Staging Light Graphics, one of the CEOs of Loose Rocker. He made it a point to point out that there is not a big money bottom ball race until August of 2019. And, you know, you had races like the No Box Nationals and heck, I don't know what was before that. There was a couple bigger bottom ball races before that that mm-hmm. are no longer around. And the No Box Nationals most certainly wasn't a failure. They had plenty of cars every year. But from what I gathered of it, the complaining of the racers wasn't worth the promoter's time in a short summary. And which, you know, Lions or Wagler Motorsports Park closing down for a year and a half didn't help anything because that was the home of the No Box Nationals, and they moved it to I-57 and they moved it back. That kind of hurt them, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what can we do? Because I feel like the No Box portion is what's going to carry this local track during this big money super pro swing. And maybe a good thing that there's no big money bottom ball races until August, so the local tracks can flourish just for that amount of time to maybe give them a hope to keep the gates open.
Yeah, actually, I mean that's exactly kind of leading perfectly into what the point I was going to make is that a lot of the no box guys don't travel a whole lot. They do stay local and they run for points at local tracks, and they are sort of the backbone, I feel like, of the local program. So
they are this nation's backbone.
So maybe it's not a bad thing. I don't know. You know, maybe it seems like the Super Pro, Top Ball, Big Bunny races, obviously, you know, promoted correctly, are well attended, and there's a certain group of, you know, however many hundred racers that are willing to drive, you know, up to 10 hours or sometimes more to go to one of those races, where as the foot brake and bottom bulb guys, I think that pool is considerably smaller. I'm completely guessing. There's still what, 250 of them that probably will, you know, but they're not going to do it maybe as often. So I don't know. Maybe the answer is that, you know, as you see, as many of these top bulb races are splitting up the foot brake and bottom bulb and the top bulb, you know, and there's running for the same purse, but maybe there's an incentive, you know, there's an extra grand or whatever there is, you know, to make it that far. Even if there's not anything, it's still, you know, it's still something, you know, for the bottom bulb guys to be separated. Those races can still be successful. And I think maybe at a more affordable entry fee, you know, format such as like a, you know, $7,500 to win, $5,000, you know, in that neighborhood for affordable entry fees, I think can be successful, you know, and obviously, I mean, you know, the Michael Beard, I mean, you know, the Bigfoot 40K races, I mean, those look to be a big success. So I think there's parts of the country where it works. But yeah, but I also think, like you said, it may not be a horrible thing, because we need these local tracks to stay open. And as more and more of the top bulb guys are going to the traveling big money circus that is right now, you know, maybe that's not a bad thing.
Yep. I agree with that, but it's definitely something that we can't bat an eye at, because it is very important and it is very crucial to keep the sport going. And many people forget that bottom bulb racing is where we started. We didn't start out with delay boxes right out of the womb. So, yeah, we'd like to hear what people think about that, but I don't know if promoting one is the answer. I don't think that's what we're trying to get out here, but I think that's definitely, it needs to be noticed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I mean, maybe it's just, you know, in markets and, you know, in a capitalist program that we have, and especially in drag racing, there's nowhere, you know, clearer than that, is the fact that, you know, people vote with their dollar, you know, and if they're willing to go support a bottom bulb race and get the word out and people go, you know, but that's just always, I don't think that the success rate is as high as the top bulb races, obviously, or you wouldn't see so many of them, you know, throwing the big money races out there. So, but yeah, you're right. You know, that's where we all started. And, you know, I occasionally decide that I'm going to try it again and then realize really fast that that's not what I'm good at. But it's still fun. You know, it's always fun, whether it's foot braking or letting off the button on the bottom is always, I've always enjoyed doing it and just never had the success. But yeah. So I think that's a good subject. So tell us your ideas. You know, please don't be afraid to chime in on our Facebook page, you know, get a hold of us. You know, tell us if somebody out there has an idea for a final round discussion, let us know what it is. You know, me and Jake will talk about anything. So just throw it out there at us and we'll jawjack about it for a little while.
Absolutely. And with that being said, sticker program is still rolling and we're about to the point where we need to order some more, but we don't let that stop you. We will take any orders for stickers. We've got quite a few left.
Mm-hmm.
$10 a set. Get a hold of Zach or myself, either one, preferably Zach, because no, I'm just kidding. Either way you guys want to do it. Jenna says she's tired of mailing him, which means I guess I got to start doing it myself. So please call Zach and order them.
Yeah, well, that's great. I'm happy to do that for you. Get a hold of me, and I will get you a set of stickers. We'll get them to you as fast as we can. We certainly appreciate all those that have already purchased sets and everybody that's tuned in to our shows. This is still growing. We're getting more and more listeners every single week, and we can't say thank you enough. You know, thank you for supporting us and sticking with us and hearing as we go through our mistakes and not giving up on us. And even though you may not agree with everything we say, we really, you know, we appreciate you sticking by us and being loyal listeners.
Yep, absolutely. And with that being said, episode Zhuyan 14 in the books, and we'll see you guys in the stadium lands. Thanks for listening.